biochemistry lecture for October 21, 2009.
I'm starting this, is that correct? So, again, if you look carefully, you can find the audio recording for that on there. Download it. It should go fit on, it's an MP3, should fit on anybody's player. And I apologize for the quality of the sound. I had it way up here, and it's too loud, so I'm bringing it down here. Hopefully, you'll be able to hear it without too much clipping. There was a lot of clipping involved with it. Let's see here. What window do I have open? I have Chapter 11 open already, but in reality, we still have to finish a little bit at 10. And so I'm going to leave 11 open, but I'm going to open up 10. Open recent. Ooh, I don't even have 10 there. Where's? That's odd. Okay. B12. I'll try not to have this on the audio recording so it isn't quite so awful. To open up 10. And here we go. And we do this. Hold on. Let me just not start from there. Where are we going to start from? Have we done that yet? This. Which one? 45. Yeah, we're not very far from the end. Okay. Excellent. Thank you so much. Okay. Here we go. Let's pray, shall we? Dear Lord, thank you again for this day. Thank you for the rain that's coming. And it nourishes and provides needed moisture for the earth and prepares the ground for beautiful springs and summers that we have here in this part of Michigan. We're grateful for the care and love that you have for us every minute of every day. Lord, we don't deserve it. Grace is the only explanation for the love and the compassion that you show for us. Let us, in turn, show grace and compassion to those around us. In Jesus' name, amen. Amen. All right. Restriction enzymes. Restriction enzymes are, in fact, one way to manipulate DNA. There's a wide variety of them. They originally were discovered in bacteria. Why do bacteria have restriction enzymes? What were they used for? What do they think restriction enzymes in bacteria are used for? Destroy viral infections, phagocyte DNA, this kind of a thing. Phage, bacteriophages and so on. So the foreign DNA, there's various types. There's a type 1, 2, and 3. We're going to restrict primarily to type 2 and 3. Type 2 and 3 actually have specific locations where they cleave the DNA. And so with that, they become predictable where the stuff gets cut. And so an enzyme that recognizes a six base sequence is called a six cutter. I don't know. That must be some inside joke or whatever. So it is what it is. So it is those things. Let's take a look. There's a type 2 restriction enzyme, which is the most common that we use. There's no ATP requirement. It recognition sites in DS. What does DS DNA stand for? What does the DS stand for? Double-stranded. So it can be whole DNA that we're talking about here. Double-stranded, two-fold axis of symmetry. The cleavage can leave a staggered or sticky ends, or can produce a blunt end. Now, staggered or sticky ends, we'll take a look at what that means in just the next couple slides. Are you done writing this down? All right, let's go ahead. The restriction enzyme coding, three-letter coding. First letter is a genus. Second and third is a species. Following letter denotes a strain. ECHO-R1 is the first restriction enzyme found in the R strain of E. coli. So ECHO-R1, restriction enzyme. It's an interesting term for an enzyme. I would have wished they would have come up with a different name. It's not as descriptive as it could be, but we certainly are using it exclusively for DNA cutting, and therefore I guess it's okay as long as they only use it for that. Let's take a look at this. A restriction mapping of a DNA molecule is determined by analysis of electrophoretic pattern obtained by different restriction endonuclease digests. Okay, keep in mind that double-stranded DNA molecule has a unique nucleotide sequence and therefore a definite polarity. Thus, fragments from one end are distinctly different, derived from fragments from another end. Now, restriction mapping, ladies and gentlemen, is not... it's an important skill, and it's one that you need to review by going over this kind of thing. There may be a slightly different graph in your book, but I definitely expect that you're going to have a question or two over restriction mapping in a quiz or test. Probably both. I would recommend that you thoroughly understand each piece of this. And so let's take a look at the various steps that they do. All right, the various steps what they do. The first thing they do is they take a particular segment of DNA that they want to, quote, map. And they hit it with a restriction enzyme. In this case, they're going to call it enzyme A. The A is a restriction enzyme, which means if it's a class 2, it has a specific spot it cuts, a specific spot that it cuts. They then realize that it only cuts in one place. So you have this big fragment that's cut in one place, which means that there are how many remaining fragments? Two. Okay. Two fragments after cutting this one larger segment. Because it cut in one specific spot. Now, the interesting question that you've got, of course, is A gives you, out of a 10 kilobase pair, a 10,000 base pair DNA fragment or segment, shall we say, you cut it with A and you get a fragment that's 3,000 bases long and a fragment that's 7,000 bases long. That's good information. Except when you try to put it together, you realize that 3 could come either at the 5 prime end or it could come at the 3 prime end. You don't know when you only have one cut. So they decide, similar but not identical to protein sequencing, they then take that same 10 kilobase segment and hit it with another restriction enzyme called B. Whatever B is, it's a restriction enzyme. B cuts it in, let's see how many places. How many places does B cut it? Two. To get how many fragments? Three fragments. That's interesting. Well, look at B. Those three fragments have how many different possible orientations? Six. You could put the biggest fragment first. You could put the biggest fragment second. You could put the biggest fragment first and put the next biggest fragment segment. Or you could have the biggest fragment first and have the smallest fragment second. I mean, it's so confusing. You have no clue if you use A or B. It's a complete mishmash. No idea. But if, however, you use both restriction enzymes simultaneously, which cut at unique places, you get the idea. So A cuts in one place. B cuts in two places. A and B must cut in how many places then? Three. A total of three. One for the A and two for the what? B. Well, cutting a segment three times, you're going to get how many fragments? Four. Okay, four fragments. All right. Now, what that means is you should be able to line up enzyme A segments, enzyme B segments, along with A and B together, the two digests, and come up with a particular order of digestion that matches the pattern that you see here. I don't have time to go through the details of it, okay? We really don't, in terms of how these things can be lined up. It's a logical puzzle. That's all it is. It's just a logical puzzle. I would spend a few minutes trying to figure out why they put it in this order or in this order. Either one of these works, turns out. There's two possible orientations. Once you've got that figured out, you now know that in this particular segment, B will cut there and A will cut there, or vice versa for that other segment. That's very important information for predictably cutting DNA of a larger fragment. So the logic is you have two individual enzyme digests, a third that's a combination of both, and you can then line up the new fragments to match the cutting order of the previous fragments, and you get the right order of the restriction enzyme digests. The map, as it were, of where the restriction enzymes digest. All right. So typically, though, what happens is they can use a computer to do this in very complex things. This is simply a training exercise to verify that you know how a restriction digest mapping exercise works. Okay? All right. So that is that. I don't know, maybe I think I might have assigned a restriction map question on chapter 4. Did I? I mean chapter 10. Oh, chapter 10? Chapter 10 I did, yeah. Did I say 4? Why did I say 4? All right. Okay, now that's it for chapter 10, is that correct? It is. All right. Okay. Let's see. Then let's do chapter 11. We'll try to get the first 16 pages. Everybody has the first 16 pages. Is that correct? All right. Well, let me go back to the very beginning. It's an excellent place to start. So does everybody have chapter 11? Okay. Excellent. Let's go ahead. Essential question is, what's the higher order structure of DNA and RNA? What methodologies have they used? DNA replication. You've seen this till you're sick of it, ladies and gentlemen. Perhaps so, perhaps not. There are some who haven't had as much biology as others. But you understand that with the parental DNA being mirror images of each other, with the CG and the TA, making a template of each of the two strands then makes a new duplex that's a copy of the previous parental strand. So this is the parental strand, and the two new strands, are they called sons or daughters? I don't know why, for some reason, they call them daughter strands. Okay. Son strands, just has a different feel to it, doesn't it? Okay. Offspring strands? Sure. How do scientists determine the primary structure of nucleic acid? They sequence it. The primary method is done by chain termination method, the dideoxy method developed by Frederick Sanger. Yes, the same Sanger that did protein sequencing. Absolutely. Base-specific chemical cleavage is also developed by Maxim and Gilbert. Both use autoradiography X-ray film X-ray film develops in response to presence of radioactive nucleotides on nucleic acid molecules. Typically, they don't do that much anymore because they're able to use non-radioactive tags to label this stuff, fluorescent tags. So they don't use autoradiography very much anymore. All right, DNA replication. DNA is a double helical molecule. Each strand of helix must be copied in complementary fashion by a DNA polymerase. All right. DNA polymerase is the one that is copying the DNA. All right, so let me ask this question. What machine, molecule duplicated? So the DNA polymerase what does it make, obviously? It replicates DNA. Is that correct? But what about the RNA polymerase? What does it replicate? Not to put too fine a point on it, what does it make? RNA. Typically, it's making what? Messenger RNA. What's the machine, however, that makes proteins? Ribosomes. Okay? Just as a quick review to make sure you understand the clear distinction between the three. Our DNA polymerase, DNA. RNA polymerase, RNA, such as messenger RNA. Ribosomes, such as proteins. All of these contain segments of RNA or DNA, mostly RNA, parts in here to help integrate the DNA or the RNA with the protein machinery that's also part of that. Each strand is template for copying. DNA polymerase has got a template and primer. Oligonucleotide that pairs with the end of a template molecule form double-strand DNA. All right, DNA polymerases add nucleotides 5' to 3'. The normal DNA So the DNA polymerase requires double-stranded DNA to start the polymerization reaction. Okay, it can't simply begin with a single-stranded template. How do cells, as well as humans, trick the DNA polymerase to start operating on a single strand? They use that primer. Oligonucleotide, and that can be either DNA or RNA, typically RNA, with the end of the template molecule to form that double-stranded beginning. All right, so here you go. The DNA polymerase copies single-stranded DNA in vitro in the presence of four oligonucleotide monomers, provided a double-stranded region of DNA artificially generated by adding a primer. An oligonucleotide capable of forming a short stretch of double-stranded DNA by base pairing with the single-stranded. The primer must have a free what? 3' end from which the new nucleotide chain can grow to first residue at the initial step of polymerization. So, let's take a look at the requirements. If you're going to duplicate DNA, you first have to have a single-stranded template, correct? Correct. You must then also have what? A primer. The primer, one of the requirements of the primer is to have a what? 3' hydroxy available. If it does not have that 3' hydroxy available, can the polymerization continue or even start? No, it can't. And then you also have to have the polymerase itself, and then you have to have these. What are these things right here? I'm circling the four colored things. What are they? Yeah, the dinucleotides. Annealing of a primer creates a short stretch of annealing. What does that mean? Is this bond that connects the primer to the single-stranded DNA, is that a covalent bond? Is that covalent in structure? No. What forces are holding that together? Can you separate the hydrogen bonds by applying heat? Yes. And so that's why they call it annealing. There is a temperature difference that causes those hydrogen bonds to either form if it's cool enough or break apart if it's hot enough. Okay? So that's only a temporary structure, theoretically. And you'll discover that's important for a process called PCR, polymerase chain reaction. There we go. All right, chain termination method. What method are they talking about? This is for sequence determination. So this is the chain termination method for sequence elucidation. Based on the DNA polymerase reaction, what you do is you run four separate reactions, four separate unknown DNA single-stranded templates. Each reaction contains the four nucleotides, one of which is P32 labeled in this case, which means the P32 means it's radioactive. Current methodology has one of them linked using a fluorescence probe that does not use radioactivity. Each reaction also contains a small amount of one dideoxynucleotide, either DDDT, DD this, yeah, DD. Now, what do you think is missing here? That dideoxynucleotide. It is missing the what? 3 prime. So write this here. Either circle it, underline it, and say, missing the 3 prime hydroxy. Now, did I say the 3 prime hydroxy was required for the continuation of this reaction? Yes, I did. So why would you want a small amount of either of these in that reaction? Not a large amount, but just a small amount. If you want some of the dideoxy, you must want sometimes the reaction not to continue. Is that right? What did I just say? You wanted sometimes the reaction to what? Not continue. It'll stop the reaction for that particular molecule that they pick up. Here it is. And I know it's difficult to read. You'll have to read it in your textbook. They may have it a different form, but that's okay. A, the DNA polymerase reaction, of course. B, structured dideoxy. Let's see, where's B? Did they show B here? Oh, yeah. Notice the dideoxy is missing that 3 prime hydroxy group. So, let's take a look at what they have in each test tube, shall we? Each test tube right here contains the template. It also contains the what? Primer. Okay. Oh! Nice catch. Landed right in his shoe upright. It's amazing. Cool. Sorry about that. It contains the 4 appropriate nucleotides and a smaller, much smaller amount of a broken nucleotide. You could have a dideoxy A, a dideoxy C, a dideoxy T, a dideoxy G, all that kind of thing. And small amounts go in each of these test tubes. Not a large amount, just a small amount. And so what happens is the polymerase immediately begins to make the DNA based on the fact the primer anneals to the appropriate segment. But every once in a while, it picks up, tries to use the dideoxy form. And it attaches it, and then it tries to bring in another DNA, nucleotide to that part. But it can't continue because it's missing the what? The 3 prime. And so it goes, well, I can't do this. And it falls off and starts working on another molecule. Okay? And so you end up having some fragments that are shorter than others, but always specific to the dideoxy that's in that particular group. In this case, it's dideoxy A, or dideoxy G, or dideoxy C, or dideoxy T. So wherever it stops is where there's that dideoxy that for that peculiar test tube. And so then they run these things down a gel, and they get the shortest ones go first, and literally they get a ladder. And they say, oh, the shortest one is at an A, the next one's at a C, the next one's at a, well, G, C, G, T, A, C, G, C. All because of the way the different fragments are made. And so you end up then being able to look at the sequence of the reaction. So, this is also an important methodology, ladies and gentlemen. You need to know this. You need to be able to tell me how you can interpret this ladder right here appropriately for the 5 prime to 3 prime end of the template. Of the template. How does this here, these lines right here, this order, relate to the template, the vertical line there? All right, let's go ahead.
Most of the time, polymerase uses normal nucleotides and DNA molecules. Normally, occasionally, notice occasionally, polymerase uses a dideoxytide, which adds the chain and then prevents further growth. Random insertion of the dideoxynucleotides leave optimally at least a few chains terminated in every occurrence of a given nucleotide. So here's the bottom line. If you wonder what in the world they're talking about, this bottom bullet tells you. The bottom bullet tells you. Random insertion of the dideoxynucleotides leaves optimally at least a few chains terminated at every occurrence of a given nucleotide. All right, you run each segment of electrophoresis, short fragments go to the bottom, long with the top, read the sequence from top to bottom, convert this sequence to the complementary sequence. Now you read from the other end and you have the sequence you wanted, read 5 prime to 3 prime. I need for you to interpret that as best you can, because I'm going to give you a little question about that, probably either on the test or on Friday. All right, so actually what I'm going to have you do is I'm going to have you read this gel. Is that okay? Yeah, I'll just have you read that gel. I'll probably start the quiz at the beginning, and then you can be done by noon. All right, so up there, and so notice that means literally they have gels. They used to do this using gels. Gels that were 3 feet tall. And they would simply run it all the way down to the bottom, and they could read up from the top. You know, it was really quite a sophisticated thing. But they now do it in an automated methodology, so the DNA sequencing is very, very rapid and pretty. Yeah. Okay, now you can do a fluorescence labeling for the same thing. Basically, one for each base, the primer each is end labeled with one of 4 different fluorescent dyes. So we don't use radioactivity anymore. Okay, and they run this through. Now the nice thing about this is a kind of a discontinuous thing where you run this gel. And you get the readout. They have automated systems where this process occurs automatically, and it comes out in a particular order. It's really very sophisticated, etc. So they use light to get the different orders of things. Quite amazing. Okay, what sorts of secondary structures can double-stranded DNA molecules adapt? The sugar phosphate backbones on the outside, the bases which are hydrogen bonded are on the inside. Right twist closes the gaps between the base pairs to about 3.4 angstroms, or 0.34 nanometers in beta DNA. Most DNA is in the beta form. We're not going to belabor the point between the difference between B form and A form and Z form, but we will be talking about that a little bit. Here's the ladder that you get, the hydrogen bonding. There's the backbone, the phosphate backbone in each case, and you end up having the thing twist around. Twist around. So, ta-da, my belt comes off again. Yay! And I picked this belt specifically just for this purpose. Notice if you would, Mr. Bobienko, don't go to sleep right there. Notice the middle of it, you were falling asleep. Yeah, it's a beautiful belt, isn't it? Yeah. Any rate, so can you recognize the ladder-like structure that you see up here? Right? And so the outside edges are what? Don't look at it too literally. Outside edges are the what? Phosphate backbone, and the middle there is the what? Hydrogen bonding. And you can almost, the bond angles actually between the braids are almost just about right. Oh, never mind, I'm teasing. At any rate, so what happens with this? Well, it ends up being twisted. And eventually you get this helix that looks like this. Don't laugh until you... I can't wait till you become a teacher. Okay? And then you're going to go, how can I convince these kids that this is true? All right. Dr. Novak used a belt. All right. And I think I'm going to use a belt. But I'm going to use a belt in a different spot. I'm going to lash it to their backs and make them study. Okay, any rate, so here we go. As you can tell, I've made a helix, is that correct? And you can see I have a major groove and a minor groove. Groovy, man. Where's the major groove? All right, what I need for you to do, could you use your finger? Just hold your up like this and then point like this. Okay, thank you. Just hold it right there. All right, so... All right, the major groove is the groove that occurs between the backbones. Okay, see there? Between there and there, right there. The minor groove is right where the hydrogen bonding goes. Okay? That's the minor groove right there. This is the major groove right here. Thank you very much. What is so funny? My hands are occupied. What'd you use? What do you want to use? My nose or something? Here, right there, that is. At any rate, I wish my pants would have fallen off with me taking off my belt, but unfortunately, I'm not that thin. Okay. Does everybody understand what I'm talking about here? Okay. Now, that has an important meaning in the future, ladies and gentlemen. So that's that. Major, minor grooves, the tops of the bases, floor. The major groove is large enough to accommodate alpha helix from a protein. Regulatory proteins and transcription factors recognize pattern bases and H-bonding in the major groove. So, when we have this major groove, the gap between the backbone, between the sugar phosphate backbone, that gap right there, is big enough for proteins to go into. The minor groove is not big enough for proteins to go into. But the proteins can fit in that groove and also recognize the bases that are part of that groove. And so you got the backbone, and you got the spaces between the backbone, the minor groove, and the major groove, and so on. And you can see the major groove is this much, and the minor groove is that much. So not too fascinating there, actually. There are different types of alpha helice, DNA structures. There's an A, a B, and a Z. The A is short and broad. The B is long and thinner, and the Z is actually backwards. It's left-handed, but it's very long and thin. So, if I was going to do a DNA, the A DNA is like this, the B DNA is more like this, and the Z DNA is actually backwards and is very long and thin. It's a left-handed helix. So that's the difference between the two. A and B are right-handed. Z is left-handed. All I want you to know is the following. The A is broad and short and right-handed. The B is longer and thinner and right-handed. And the Z is elongated, slim, and left-handed. That's the only information I need for you to know about these types of secondary structures of the DNA. All right, originally DNA was first discovered by Alex Rich. I don't care, actually, about Alex Rich. It's found in typically GC-rich regions of DNA. All I need for you to do is circle that bullet point. The rest of it is irrelevant to our discussion here. The first bullet point is found in CG-rich regions of DNA. Z-DNA doesn't occur that much. And it's almost an artifact of X-ray crystallography. Yes? We don't have that? You guys don't have this?
No.
Oh, the first 16. Yeah, so have I gone through 16 slides already? Ooh. I'm going to have to go, though. Yeah, it's I thought I was only going to get through 16. Normally, I didn't get through 16, but that's okay. This stuff is going to be, it's right now available on D2L. So you're going to have to, I don't know what, someone tell me what has to be filled. Does anything have to be filled in on this page?
No.
Okay. Anything have to be filled on this page?
No.
Okay. This is materials. The reason I have this thing right here, and it's kind of an odd slide in the middle of nowhere, is it shows a principle that's important for cancer-causing materials. There are compounds such as ethidium bromide that are extremely potent cancer-causing agents, primarily because they interrupt the DNA stacking. All right, so Andrew, could you mind? Could I use your hands? Just, all right, just, yep, sit up a little bit higher. All right, good. All right, so what happens here is just like this. So imagine, if you would, this is a couple of base paired DNA bases, and this is another base pair of DNA, and they're stacked normally. An intercalcating agent such as athenium bromide, notice the number of rings there that it has, is also flat. It can fit in between there, and when it does, it distorts the separation distance between the DNA stacks. So what was normally this close, athenium bromide comes in, stretches it out, and then when it begins to be duplicated, it begins to have errors in duplication, and that you end up having mistakes in the DNA base pairing and so on because of that intercalcating agent. So thank you very much. So all three of these agents that you have listed here fit inside the base pairs of the DNA and cause problems with getting correct pairing during duplication. And that can cause serious disease, primarily cancer. Some of these, of course, like actinomycin, apparently have bacterial DNA that are particularly susceptible to this, and therefore can be used as an antibiotic and destroy the DNA, the bacteria's ability to replicate, and therefore give the immune system a chance to overcome any bacterial infections. But I certainly want you to know ethidium bromide. Ethidium bromide is also used in biology, isn't it, quite a bit?
Yeah.
What context? What's it used for?
Gels.
What's its purpose in gel? Oh, you guys are just really... I don't even know. I know they do use it. But I know it's horribly toxic.
It makes the gel easier to read.
Is it something to make the gel easier to read? Well, man, that's just, I mean, it's like using a loaded gun, because, I mean, this stuff is just terribly, terribly toxic. And you get you only get the worst diseases with that stuff. Now, the body can tolerate a little bit of it, microscopic amounts of it, there's a couple things it has to be used for. They haven't found a suitable substitute. But, man, if you ever have to use this stuff, you be careful, okay? Right? Is it that funny?
No, it's just
never. All right. Anyway, can the secondary structure of DNA be denatured and renatured? Yes, it can. Notice when DNA is heated to 80 degrees above Celsius or 80 degrees plus Celsius, UV absorbance is increased by 30-40%. This is called this hyperchromic shift. Underline that term. Hyperchromic shift reflects the unwindings of DNA double helix. In other words, the stacked base pairs in native DNA absorb less light. So when it's stacked, I'm going to have to use your arms again there. Hope you don't mind, Andrea. Okay, so you got DNA base pairs. They're going to be hydrogen bonded like this. And when they're stacked like this, they then absorb less ultraviolet than when they melt and don't become and do not have the structure of being stacked on top of each other. So individual strands of DNA, the single-stranded, absorb ultraviolet more than when they're bonded and stacked like this. So when DNA melts, it's called a hyperchromic shift because it absorbs more or less DNA. More unstacked and un-double-stranded. Thank you very much. All right. So here you see this. And I want you to note, I guess I'm nearly done. I want you to note the S shape of these curves. We'll talk about that on tomorrow. Now, if you remember, we didn't meet last Thursday, but we're having to meet what? This Thursday. Tomorrow. We're meeting tomorrow. Remember, it's only a day away.